Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The director is out of the country, and he asked in his absence if I would preside over this lecture, which I've got much pleasure in doing. This is the second of two lectures sponsored by BP, given by Professor John Williamson on the Eastern Transition to a Market Economy, a Global Perspective. And I would like to reiterate on behalf of the director how much the school appreciates BP's benefaction, enabling us to be addressed by such a distinguished economist as Professor Williamson. My understanding is that yesterday Professor Williamson discussed some of the economic prescriptions for Eastern Europe, including his own, and indeed at the beginning he's going to summarize what he said yesterday. This evening he's going to talk about how those prescriptions have been received. Before I invite him to address you, he told me that he has some slides that he's going to show, and they might be a bit difficult for those of you sitting upstairs to see if you're further than the first three rows. So if you'd like to move forward a bit, I think you'll get a better view. Can I invite Professor Williamson to address us?
Thank you very much. Well, I won't spend a long time summarizing what I said yesterday, but just in case there are people who weren't here yesterday, let me give some idea of what the gist of it was. I reviewed the reasons for the failure of the socialist experiment, and I outlined the main components of the reform package that we economists, who seem to be unusually united on this issue, have concluded are needed in order to allow the transition to a market economy. I pointed out the basic similarity in the content of those reforms that have been increasingly implemented around the world in this last decade, and what is being prescribed for Eastern Europe, and indeed introduced at breakneck speed, which, however, are perforce more extensive than the reforms elsewhere because of the absence of the infrastructure of a market economy. But one has the emphasis on the same three objectives: stabilization, liberalization, and opening up. I then described what I saw as the logic underlying the mainstream position, and then I outlined the main controversy that has arisen during the debate, namely the merits of a Big Bang, an idea whose origins I suggested could be traced to Bolivia. I'm going to start this second lecture by examining the facts about what has happened so far in the transition, and then I'll proceed to examine alternative explanations for the massive declines in output that have occurred, and we'll then ask what lessons need to be drawn from the experience so far, including lessons as regards what the West ought to be doing. The breadth of the reforms that have been introduced in Eastern Europe in the 2.5 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall is truly awesome. One had first Poland, then Eastern Germany, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania, and most recently Russia, who have adopted in substance the sort of package of price liberalization, fiscal discipline, in most cases monetary discipline as well, enterprise autonomy, something in the way of the provision of a social safety net, plus current account convertibility and devaluation, which was the sort of package that I outlined yesterday as stemming from certainly my analysis and I think the mainstream analysis of this question. Eastern Germany has, of course, gone a lot further, notably with massive privatization already accomplished by the Treuhand. Hungary has got about as far as the leaders of the other countries in terms of liberalization, but because it initially had a head start through a gradual liberalization program over the years, it hasn't had to introduce any equivalent of a Big Bang. It's been able to continue with a piecemeal or gradualist approach. What that leaves, still not having taken that initial step, are the CIS states other than Russia and, of course, Albania. They still have to take the plunge. Now, the expectation at the time when those programs were announced was that they would produce a sharp initial increase in prices, a corrective inflation, as a result of price liberalization, the monetary overhang being inflated away, and devaluation pulling prices up. But the hope was that after the initial step price increases, inflation would quickly die away. The argument was there would no longer be a monetary overhang. Fiscal and monetary policy would eliminate excess demand. And at least in the Central European countries, the idea was that the exchange rate would provide a nominal anchor. And so from then on, one would have price stability. All countries, except Eastern Germany, which effectively had a revaluation rather than a devaluation when monetary unification occurred, but all the other countries did indeed have large initial price increases, in every case, I think, substantially larger than had been anticipated. In only one country was the aim of having a one-shot price increase realized. That one country was Czechoslovakia, where price stability was achieved within months of the Big Bang. In all the other cases, or at least in several of the other cases, inflation did fall back again from what it was around the period of the Big Bang, or even in the period immediately preceding, but there was an uncomfortable degree of persistence in inflation. And that, in turn, has been accommodated through a flexible exchange rate policy, a frequently adjusted peg in Hungary, a crawling peg, Professor Goodhart, in Poland, and floating exchange rates, at least in Bulgaria and Russia. But inflation clearly remains a problem everywhere except perhaps Czechoslovakia. But the worst news relates to output. Table 1 here really matters. Table 1 indicates some figures for the rough changes, the rough reductions in both GDP and industrial production in the various Eastern European countries. Now, these figures come from a Morgan Stanley report issued last month, and I've rounded them very severely because I don't believe the figures are worth that much. I think they get orders of magnitudes right. I know that I think Dr. Gomulka would say that the Polish output fall is overestimated by 5% or so there. So just to not give you the impression that these figures are very accurate, I have rounded them severely. And incidentally, they're probably biased on the downward side, that is towards making bigger decreases than have really happened, because in many countries the statistical basis for these comparisons largely excludes the private sector. It's really the state sector, which is decreasing, which gets measured, and the private sector doesn't get measured, and therefore the private sector, of course, is growing very rapidly, dramatically rapidly in most cases, from a tiny base, but nevertheless enough to maybe mean that these figures are 1-3% bigger output declines than have really been happening after you allow for the private sector. But in any event, after you have made all those allowances, you can see that the declines in output have been massive. Biggest in Eastern Germany, where GDP was estimated to have fallen by 45% and industrial production by 65%. Smallest in Hungary, with figures of 15 and 30% respectively. Now, I provide some historical perspective at the bottom by showing the declines in output during the Great Depression in the United States, Britain, and Germany. And as you can see, we have figures there varying between 12% and 28%. In other words, the lower end of the range of output declines in Eastern Europe. So this is a quite different order of magnitude to the little local difficulties that are confronting Mr. Major and President Bush as a result of the current Western recession. There's just no comparison between these massive declines in output and the recession about which we all worry so much. Well, critics of the Big Bang strategy tend to claim that these output falls provide strong support for their position. Before assessing that contention, I want to discuss how far we understand the causes of this collapse in output.
You know, in thinking about that,
let me start by reviewing the sort of conventional taxonomy. That we would all tend to use if we were discussing the reasons for a decline in output in developing countries. We would say that output might decline either because of demand or supply, and if it fell before because of demand, we would want to know whether that was external demand or internal demand. Among external demand, we would distinguish between an exogenous decline due to world recession and a decline in demand which came about because the exchange rate was allowed to become overvalued. On internal demand, we would think of that as being a Keynesian demand deficiency, and then we might want to distinguish the special case where there was a foreign exchange shortage which had compelled a recession, a cutback in internal output. The sort of thing that's analyzed in the two-gap model. I indicate special cases as opposed to things that are supposed to be different by a dash in front of the item. And then on the supply side, the sort of thing that we think of are exogenous shocks caused by the weather, bad weather, or natural disasters. Now, the first few entries in this taxonomy can remain unchanged when one comes to consider what may be causing an output decline in Eastern Europe. I hope that people can see this. If you want to move down closer to the front to be able to see better, please feel free. We can start off with very much the same classification, looking at external demand and internal demand. On the external demand side, again, we would want to distinguish between an exogenous decline and an overvalued currency. Where one has the production facilities previously being used to supply an external market specific to that market, then there is, of course, a particularly severe welfare impact. Now, in the second column here, I have tried to give an indication of which countries are most affected, according to the reports that I have seen at any rate, which countries are affected by particular factors. If we take the case of the exogenous decline in production, in export demand, the important case here is the fall in demand from the Soviet Union, which had an impact on all the economies in transition in Eastern Europe. This fall in demand has even been quantified in a recent paper by Danny Roderick. It accounts for 1.6% of GDP in Poland. These are direct effects before adding in any multiplier effects. 1.6% of GDP in Poland, 2.2% in Czechoslovakia, 4.5% in Hungary. But the biggest impact, I think, was in Bulgaria, which was dependent on the Soviet market to the extent of about 60% of its total exports. And it was also a fairly export-dependent country. So I have listed the countries there in what I think is the order of importance of this particular source of shock. The final column then goes on to present a first assessment of the welfare significance of each of these sources of output decline. Now, an exogenous decline in foreign demand confronts a country with an unavoidable welfare loss, and that's greater the more difficult it is to transfer the resources formerly used to produce exports into alternative uses. Of course, in the case of exports from these countries to the Soviet Union, they were previously what are called shoddy goods, which are more or less unsaleable in the West at any price. And so the welfare impact is particularly severe. The second heading in the table is currency overvaluation. An overvalued currency can destroy the tradable goods industries and thus reduce output. Think back to the early 1980s in the British case. So far, that effect seems to have been important only in Eastern Germany, among these economies, where the one-to-one exchange rate chosen at the time of German monetary union made East German costs hopelessly uncompetitive. Now, I would not claim that matters could have been materially alleviated by choosing a different exchange rate at the time of unification. The fact that East German wages rose sharply after unification suggests that the competitive benefits of a more competitive exchange rate would have been inflated away very quickly. I think essentially exchange rate policy was impotent in that case because of the high degree of labour mobility combined with the willingness of Western Germany to pay almost unlimited sums to curtail the migration of workers to the West. But it nevertheless remains true that if one is classifying sources of output, the output collapse, then I think Eastern Germany, one has to say, the uncompetitive exchange rate was the factor. It looked last year as though the Polish zloty was also in danger of becoming overvalued, but Poland began to crawl its exchange rate last September, and perhaps that was just in time to avoid a significant overvaluation emerging. So the only country I enter in column two of this diagram is Eastern Germany. Now, in general, I would classify currency overvaluation as a social loss due to policy error, an avoidable loss, what I call an avoidable loss in the third column of this table. Although a modest and temporary overvaluation can be a rational part of a program of combating inflation, and therefore you can classify it as an investment in stability. The phrase I have up there on the right-hand side, avoidable loss when excessive, is an attempt to convey the notion that some output loss from this source may be a rational investment, but that when it's carried too far, it avoids social waste. But in the particular case of Eastern Germany, I think it's fair to classify the overvaluation as exogenous because of Western Germany's willingness to pay subsidies of over 50% of West German GDP in order to curtail migration. The third heading in the table, we turn now to internal demand factors, and it's Keynesian demand efficiency. Tightened fiscal and monetary policy. In principle, we know that with rational expectations, universally believed, it may be total credibility, it may be possible to stabilize without any output cost at all. But typically, stabilization does have at least a temporary cost in terms of lost output, perhaps because of the need to build credibility, perhaps not all expectations are rational, perhaps because of the structure of contracts. In any way, it's a well-established fact that there normally is such an output loss. And that, again, I would classify it as an investment if it's no larger than is needed to achieve stabilization, but a case of social waste if demand deflation overshoots. Now, there was a vigorous debate in Poland as to whether demand deflation was responsible for the depth of the Polish recession. And for a time, I subscribed to the view that an excessive devaluation at the beginning of the stabilization program, at the time of the Big Bang, had replaced monetary overhang by monetary stringency, reducing real balances, and in that way led to excessive deflation. And then the fiscal surplus in the first half of 1990 reinforced that charge of overkill. But in an interesting recent paper, Dr. Gomulka has pointed out that the bulk of the Polish money supply at the end of 1989 was actually denominated in dollars rather than in zlotys, and therefore its internal purchasing power is actually increased rather than decreased by the devaluation. So it's rather difficult to argue that the real bounce effect led to a recession.
Right.
And since then, of course, the budget deficit has reappeared while inflation has not vanished. So I think it's difficult to classify Poland as a case of deflationary overkill, and that's why it appears in this table only with a query. The case that perhaps is deflationary overkill is the one that came up in the discussion during question time yesterday, and that is the case of Czechoslovakia, which I think is a shame because the microeconomics of the transition were handled better in Czechoslovakia than anywhere else, which really did follow the sort of recommendations that were summarized in my first lecture. But nevertheless, because macroeconomic policy appears to have been too contractionary, there was also a large output fall in the case of Czechoslovakia. we then coming down the table one to the next item, we have the special case of a foreign exchange shortage. Now, when I was a student at LSE, we took it as axiomatic that inadequate foreign exchange could force a country into deflationary policies. But nowadays, that seems to be doubted by people whose education has been excessively concentrated in the neoclassical tradition. So let me try and just outline the argument as to why it is possible that a freely floating exchange rate does not make this a non-problem. Consider a country whose exports are less than its full employment imports at a competitive exchange rate, where I define that as a fundamental equilibrium exchange rate. Those of you who've read some of my other writings will be familiar with that animal. Let me just very briefly say that's an exchange rate such as to induce balanced trade, or at least a desirable, sustainable balance of payments position at full employment in the medium term. So we're at an exchange rate which can get us where we want to be in the medium term. But it's well known that exchange rate policy takes a long time to induce an output, a response on the export side. So suppose that we are in the medium run before exports have had a chance to build up to their steady state level, so that there is a trade deficit at full employment. And the question is, does it follow that devaluation could necessarily reconcile internal and external balance in the short run? To that, I think the answer is clearly no. The short-run effect of devaluation in switching expenditure towards domestic goods is small. That's a well-established fact. And you don't get capital inflows as an alternative way of financing in a situation where there is a chronic lack of creditworthiness, such as afflicts Eastern Europe at the moment. Thus, the mechanism that will achieve external balance in the short run with a floating exchange rate is a downward float until domestic inflation has deflated real money balances to a sufficiently depressed level to achieve trade balance. And that, of course, occurs at the cost of the level of output, or in other words, internal balance is sacrificed. Now, it may be possible to limit that output loss by restricting imports, as we discussed during the question period after yesterday's lecture, and that's what Western Europe did during the years of post-war reconstruction. That's something that can be efficient if protection that is confined to imports that compete with domestic production can buy more expenditure switching per unit of inflationary pressure than can be achieved by devaluation, which I'm sure is generally true, although it's not quite tautological. Where that alternative exists and can buy enough balance of payments improvement to enable you to get to full employment in the short run, then I think tolerating a loss of output because of the foreign exchange constraint is another cause of social waste. But where that alternative doesn't exist because the foreign exchange constraint is simply too severe, then a foreign exchange shortage has to be classified as imposing an unavoidable loss. Now, that's what I try to summarize in the last sentence of the last column of this table, but you have to look down here in the footnote for the qualification which I have just described to you as to whether this is a case of avoidable loss or unavoidable loss. The basic point is that sometimes it is possible to reduce output loss through transitional protection, but that cannot be taken for granted. There's no question that several East European countries have been foreign exchange constrained in the past couple of years. I think most critically, Bulgaria, but certainly also Romania, and in 1991, the Soviet Union. And all the successor states of the Soviet Union face a foreign exchange constraint in the future. Russia has the best prospects of getting out, of overcoming that constraint relatively rapidly because of its supplies of energy and raw materials. But even there, we shall be lucky if we see the foreign exchange constraint vanquished in the short term. I fear that those constraints are more severe than can plausibly be dealt with by transitional tariffs. In other words, at least some of these cases are in the category where they face an unavoidable loss on account of the foreign exchange constraint. Other countries have certainly suffered from a foreign exchange constraint. They've certainly suffered from various shocks that have worsened their foreign exchange availability, notably the change in the abolition of the CMEA, and the increase in the price of imports of energy from the Soviet Union, but it's not clear that they've in fact been foreign exchange constrained, so I've not included them in that row of table three. Now, if we can get that far on the basis of the standard taxonomy we get from considering developing countries, at that point we get into discussing other factors which don't arise in the case of developing countries. And to begin with, there are at least two demand-side effects, at least I classify them as demand-side effects, that have been blamed for reducing output in Eastern Europe. The first of these we can call demand shift. When there's a shift of demand from one type of good to another, then resources have to be redeployed from producing one to the other, and there's typically a delay between their release and their reabsorption in different activity, and in the meantime they produce nothing and output declines. For example, in Czechoslovakia last year, government production for the government declined by 12% of GDP, which is an enormous reduction. Now, all of that, or practically all of that, was remitted in tax cuts, but if it takes time to build up production of consumer goods in place of what it was that the government was buying before, then in the interim one has a decline in output. An important cause of a demand shift in an economy that's integrating into the world economy is from the production of import substitutes to that of exports. And that shift, again, you can think of as being in the nature of an investment. It's an immediate cost that will bear fruit in the future as redeployment into higher productivity activities actually occurs. But in the meantime, it causes an output loss, and again, if there is a large release of resources from one activity before they can be absorbed into another, that is an inefficiency. And indeed, I think one can say it's inefficient to have large pools of resources that are made idle years before they can be reabsorbed elsewhere. And that's the justification for transitional senile industry protection, that it's better that until they can be reabsorbed elsewhere, resources should produce goods of low value added than they shouldn't add any value at all. So here I divide my entry in the third column, the welfare implications of a demand shift into a slow demand shift, which one can regard as an investment, and an excessive demand shift, which again produces an avoidable social loss. Now, a special form of demand shift occurs when goods that were formerly produced are no longer wanted. The unwanted goods are military supplies, most obviously. Military procurement has been cut by something like 85% in Russia, for example. But there are other things as well. Inventories that were formerly accumulated as a store of value because financial assets couldn't play that role. There were no financial assets capable of playing that role. And also investment goods, whose only purpose was to produce unwanted goods, including more investment goods with no end use. Now, the typical example is steel, which is used to build steelworks in order to build more steelworks. And there was a lot of that went on as well. Now, production of fewer unwanted goods is a benefit and not a cost. So that's how it's entered in the third column there. That's a major factor in the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, where the military-industrial complex was vast, perhaps as much as 25% of GDP. And surplus inventories and pointless investment activities were also extensive. Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be any serious estimate of just how extensive all this added up to, but I think one can say that in Russia, at least, this was a major factor, and in all the countries it was significant, except perhaps Hungary. Let me now turn to the supply side. One can again start with the sort of exogenous shock that figured in the previous taxonomy, although there isn't much reason to attribute the decline in East European production to that source, except possibly for part of the fall in the output of petroleum in the former Soviet Union. Of vastly more importance is the fact that price changes make some part of former output uneconomic. Now, the extreme case of that is where the production of a good requires inputs with a higher value at world prices than the value of the good that is being produced, the case where one has negative value added, the case that I talked about yesterday of Polish production of semi-tropical flowers. There is a paper by Hare and Hughes which calculated that between 19% and 24% of the industrial production in the three Central European countries fell in this category of being negative value added. Perhaps that's an overestimate because it doesn't allow any possibility of substitution between different inputs. On the other hand, it doesn't make any allowance for the costs of pollution that were often involved in these types of industries. So it may be that there's quite a substantial element there. In general, I think it's clear that an end to production of goods with negative value added is another benefit almost as great as ending the production of bads. Although Ronald McKinnon did try arguing that it was a good idea to protect industries for a time that were producing negative value added so as to give them a chance to adjust. I think one can't rule out the possibility that some industries or enterprises that presently produce negative value added might be capable of adjusting and producing positive value added and becoming viable. But I must say that I think I would want to see evidence that the present value of saving an activity was likely to be positive before I went out of my way to defend value subtraction. And in the absence of such evidence, we should treat the demise of such activities as another benefit. So that's where I have negative value added being a benefit. However, one can't take it for granted that only activities with negative value added may be forced out, forced to close down by the reforms. There may also be industries which are producing positive but low value added, that's LVA, which are just not able to produce, to earn enough in order to pay the factors at their conventional rates. And so one may also have the closing down of activities which produce positive but low value added. Now, again, on that one, I think one can say if it's modest, it's on a modest scale, happening gradually, it's an investment which makes good sense. But if it's on a massive scale, happening faster than resources can be absorbed elsewhere, then one is going to get activities, then one is going to get an avoidable loss. And so again, I've put that in the final column as an avoidable loss where excessive. I think this is the real case for MacKinnon's transitional protection. It's defending, it's protecting senile industries. That's a far more promising cause in Eastern Europe than infant industry protection a la MacKinnon. It's to keep things that aren't really worth having, but to keep them going until you can build something else. There's another supply-side reason for output declines has been the dislocation of input supplies. As enterprises stop supplying goods through the traditional channels that were dictated by the planners, their customers may have difficulty in arranging alternative sources of supply. And in the Soviet Union, or the former Soviet Union, there were fears that the new international boundaries between what are now sovereign states may result in disrupting input supplies. And the output that is lost through that type of dislocation is a case of pure social loss. What is not clear is whether this is a cost that can legitimately be attributed to liberalization rather than to the collapse of the old regime. Let me mention the Soviet case, which is where the disruption of input supplies has certainly been a major factor. As Soviet central planning broke down, more and more enterprises began to neglect their duty to fulfill their state orders before selling some of their output at free market prices through the commercial exchanges. These exchanges, they're still less than two years old, but there are something like 400 or 500 of them now, which deal in everything from primary commodities to used steel rails, that was actually the first item being sold the day I went to one, to consumer goods. Their rapid emergence is a standing refutation of the charge that Russians lack entrepreneurial instincts. Now, at first blush, I think one would assume that a market that provided a mechanism for enterprises to relieve their bottlenecks by buying critical missing inputs could hardly fail to be welfare-enhancing. But I'm afraid one has to ask where the supplies sold on these exchanges come from before one can reach that conclusion. Because in many cases, supplies have been diverted. The supplies that have been diverted also seem to have been responsible for creating bottlenecks. In an environment where there's no mechanism that enables managers to know which state orders are supplying critical needs and which are dispensable, even if there were an incentive for the managers to respect such priorities, which in fact was also lacking, it's at least possible that a part of the reason for the collapse in output is that input supplies have been arbitrarily disrupted in order to earn the much higher prices available from sales on the commercial exchanges. Presumably, one benefit of liberalization will be to make the more conservative enterprises willing to trade on the exchanges or to bid the market price, thus diminishing the danger that supplies will be diverted from high priority to low priority uses. Now, that gives ground to hope that after the current initial period of chaos, as supply relationships are changed, liberalization may decrease rather than increase output losses from this source. Now, my final supply-side effect comes from a credit squeeze. This is a factor that has been emphasized in recent analysis by Calvo and Coricelli. The withdrawal of subsidies, coupled with massive devaluation and severe limits on credit expansion, meant that enterprises no longer commanded the credit to buy the inputs they needed to continue producing the former level of output. The argument is they resorted to increased levels of inter-enterprise credit to try and circumvent the shortage of bank credit, and the authorities also tried to limit that circumvention. But Calvo and Coricelli argue that this can explain a number of the apparent paradoxes of the Polish stabilization program. The coexistence in enterprises that are essentially labor-controlled of high profitability with wages that were less than the ceiling that was allowed by the incomes policy, and the coexistence of continuing inflationary pressures with the fall in output and the rise in unemployment. And I find that very convincing, though I have to confess that perhaps my approval is encouraged by the confirmation that theory seems to provide for one of my longest standing convictions, which is that any government that allows its exchange rate to become seriously misaligned has to run into big trouble. Specifically, I can still blame some of Poland's troubles on the excessive Polish devaluation, even though Dr. Gomulka tells me that there wasn't a real balance effect. I think conditions in Czechoslovakia seem to be similar. There may well have been some credit stringency there. And Hungary, there's also been an explosion of inter-enterprise credit, and hence perhaps one should also look for this factor in Hungary. I think a credit squeeze beyond what is necessary to control demand and to impose hard budget constraints on enterprises has to be counterproductive, and accordingly I describe that as an avoidable loss. Well, let me now turn and ask whether the above assessment of the factors that have led to the collapse in output suggests that the sort of advice we economists have been giving is seriously misconceived. Let me make a few general points about the conclusions I draw from this table. The first one is that there are an awful lot of reasons why output might have been expected to decline. Unfortunately, apart from Roderick's estimates of the impact of the Soviet demand shock and the Hare and Hughes attempt to measure the prevalence of negative value added, we have no quantitative estimates that would enable us to decompose the output decline among the various possible causes. And that's a serious lack of, it's a serious ignorance on our part, I fear. Now, I'm not sure that my taxonomy is perfect in the sense that it's mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive, but I hope that maybe it's good enough to stimulate some effort into decomposing the sources of the collapse. Second, what we do show is that some output losses were positively desirable. Others were unavoidable, and others were in the nature of an investment. Now, I don't doubt that there are also still remaining some avoidable losses, but I think that their magnitude is less, and perhaps substantially less, than that of the decline in output. A third general point is that any generalized accusation of excessive demand deflation appears to be unwarranted. I think one can make that complaint against policy in Czechoslovakia, but elsewhere I don't see much justification for it. apart from that excessive demand deflation in Czechoslovakia, the table suggests two other areas where policy may have erred. One is in not providing the substantial transitional protection to buffer the adjustment process. And it's one thing to argue in favor of starting off adjustment quickly on a broad front, the sort of bang type of analysis, and it's another to demand that the system go straight to free trade prices. I think the problems of adjustment in response to demand shift, foreign exchange shortage, and low value added as a result of price changes all seem to call for transitional protection. And that's one of the issues that remains controversial among the economists who discuss the sort of advice that should be given to Eastern Europe, but I'm very clear on which side I come down, even though I don't accept McKinnon's original justification for that advice. The other policy error that I think one has to detect is the excessive squeeze on credit. One decision that was made in every stabilization program so far was to inflate away the monetary overhang, even where there wasn't one, like in Czechoslovakia, rather than to undertake a monetary reform, as happened in most European countries other than Britain after World War II. Now, it's increasingly being argued that this was a mistake. The monetary overhang was inflated away by a policy of severe devaluation to an exchange rate close to the prior black market rate, accompanied by price liberalization and the withdrawal of subsidies. The fact that the exchange rate was fixed subsequent to its devaluation was described as providing a nominal anchor, but since the exchange rate was in fact so devalued as to pull prices up, it seems to me it would have been more appropriate to describe it as providing a nominal balloon. This large devaluation gave enterprises headroom to raise prices and wages without the hard budget constraint biting. and presumably a degree of inflationary momentum built up from what was supposed to be a one-shot price increase, hence the persistence of inflation everywhere except in Czechoslovakia, where the demand deflation overshot. The monetary overhang was quickly not only inflated away, but replaced by a monetary shortage, or perhaps more accurately, by a credit shortage, which depressed demand and thus output, suppressed supply and thus output, while not necessarily being very effective at controlling inflation. Now, the alternative policy would have been to have a monetary reform designed to absorb the monetary overhang without large price increases, accompanied by an initial wage freeze and an exchange rate that was fixed so as to validate the existing wage level. Now, at least in the Soviet Union, monetary reform was rejected out of hand because of recollections of the bitter public reaction to Pavlov's monetary reform, in quotes, of January 1991. I think that this was a serious mistake. Inflating away the overhang results in its confiscation just as much as any monetary reform does. And moreover, confiscating money balances in excess of some threshold isn't the only possible form of monetary reform. Indeed, it seems a very silly form in countries that have a vast stock of assets needing to be privatized and virtually no non-monetary savings that the public can call on in order to buy those assets. It's not practicable to mop up the overhang directly by selling assets because privatization takes time if it's to be done properly. But what it would have been possible to do is to issue some form of privatization certificate that could have been used to purchase assets in due course in exchange for money holdings in excess of whatever threshold was allowed to be converted into the new money. A different type of complaint is that the reform programs have once again committed the mistake of concentrating overwhelmingly on the demand side, when in fact the real problems of the ex-socialist economies lie on the supply side. Now, that complaint comes in two main variants. One is the complaint that privatization has been too delayed. I think most of us would have liked to see privatization move faster, especially of the supply and distribution network in Russia. Actually, I'm sure the same is true of Gaidar and his team, but small privatization happens to be a local responsibility in Russia, not something whose pace can be decreed by the economic team. However, I would resist the idea that rapid large-scale privatization of large enterprises could have helped. Again, the point is it takes time to privatize well, and it's most inadvisable to privatize before price reform, for fear of driving viable enterprises into bankruptcy. The other complaint, which is voiced in a recent paper of Tadrubchinsky, is that banking reform, including recapitalization of the banks, should have preceded, or at least accompanied, price liberalization, so that the financial system would have been in a position to carry out its function of intermediating funds to those enterprises able to make a supply-side response. Now, once again, that's something that one would surely have liked to see happen sooner, although I think there is some question as to how much a reconstruction of balance sheets could do before the banks acquire personnel trained in the art of loan appraisal. And that's a serious comment. That is one of the serious manpower deficiencies in Eastern Europe. But despite that caveat, I think there's a case for wiping the slate clean of debt inherited from the past, so as to permit a real hardening of budget constraints. You really can't do that when enterprises there's a big web of inter-enterprise credit, and bankrupting one enterprise may bankrupt others, which would be perfectly viable, but for the fact that they have a lot of debt outstanding from the past. And it becomes very difficult to impose hard budget constraints in that environment. So I would favor a sort of equivalent to monetary reform so far as enterprises and the banking sector are concerned in order to wipe the slate clean. Now, what emerges from this review is that there may have been too little transitional protection, that one might have wished for more rapid privatization, especially of the supply and distribution networks in Russia, and that a widespread mistake has been in not opting for monetary reform and an analogous sanitization of the balance sheets of enterprises and banks. But note that those latter operations would have been accomplished most naturally as another component of a bang, thus tending to make bangs bigger rather than smaller. So the question we come to is transitional protection the only crumb that we should concede to the criticisms of the gradualists? Now, the gradualist case is based on the superior performance of countries that have opted for a more gradual strategy of adjustment, notably China and Hungary. China, as mentioned in questions yesterday, has certainly shown impressive growth ever since it started liberalizing over a decade ago. However, I think the existence of a large, relatively self-contained agrarian sector, which was just itching to get back to non-collectivist production practices, created an opportunity for gradual reform in China of a sort that was absent in Eastern Europe. Hungary is perhaps a more relevant comparator. It's true that Hungary also experienced an output decline, but it is somewhat less severe than elsewhere in Eastern Europe, and I think more relevant, there seems to be general agreement that it's the best place of the East European countries, apart from Eastern Germany, to resume growth in the near future. What those two cases certainly do demonstrate is that gradualist strategies exist, at least starting from certain places. It's evidently not true that a commitment to gradualism guarantees that a country will never make the transition. The analogy of a chasm that has to be crossed in a single leap is unpersuasive, so I hope we can resolve that in future we will try to analyze questions and not resort to analogies, which are often misleading. However, existence is not the same as optimality. It's at least possible that Hungary would be better off by now if it had invested in bolder reforms in the past, even if that strategy had brought with it a larger initial output decline. Where a country has a choice between a decisive package and gradualism, as Czechoslovakia did, it still seems to me reasonable to make the choice that was made in Czechoslovakia, preferably without the mistake in demand management. And also, I think one has to point out that the biggest output collapse of all, although it actually wasn't shown as such in the figures at the beginning, in Table 1, but I think that's a deficiency of those figures, reportedly the biggest output collapse of all, except possibly Eastern Germany, is Albania, and that can't be attributed to a big bang because there hasn't been any reform program in Albania yet. I think the really critical point is that for most of the economies in transition, the really decisive argument in favor of a bang is quite different to that discussed in my first lecture. Most of these economies, the exceptions being Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Eastern Germany, really didn't have a choice. They were in a state of collapse when the reformers took office. Prices were rising despite the maintenance of price controls. Many goods had disappeared from the shelves. There were large budget deficits that had accumulated over time into monetary overhangs. The balance of payments was in crisis. The currency had become absurdly undervalued on the back market, reflecting the lack of confidence. Corruption was rampant, output had started to decline. Under those conditions, there really was no option of gradualism, of allowing a private sector to grow in parallel to the public sector and making modest changes one at a time, calculated to repair the most glaring defect evident at that moment. Drastic problems call for drastic remedies, and the architects of reform in Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, and Russia have simply bowed to force majeure in opting for big bangs. Let me spend just a few minutes discussing what is at stake in securing a successful transition. And first, consider what's at stake for the peoples of the countries directly involved. Presumably, success will lead to absorption in the Western mainstream, construction of pluralist civil societies practicing democracy and enjoying increasing prosperity. It'll take a long time, half a century under the best of circumstances, before living standards might approach those in North America, Northern Europe, and Japan. But communism did bequeath those countries with populations that were sufficiently educated to give one reasonable confidence that they will succeed in starting to converge on the leading countries once sensible institutions and policies are in place. the big doubt must be whether they will have the patience to start that process. Once recovery is underway, the fact that they're still a lot less affluent than the other peoples of the temperate zone is unlikely to seem unbearably irksome. I doubt whether the alternative to this comfortable, if some doubtless, an exciting future is a reversion to anything approaching Stalinism, or fascism for that matter. I think something resembling Argentina in the decades between Perón and Menem is more likely. A succession of coups and democratic restorations, of populist experiments that bring temporary upturns at the cost of further undermining the fundamentals, and programs that restore the fundamentals but are never sustained to the point of giving recovery a chance. Or perhaps, particularly in Russia, it will involve the collapse of the authority of the central state and the emergence of warring sub-jurisdictions on the Yugoslav model. Whatever the form this alternative takes, dangers of mass misery, of endless calls on the Western purse, large-scale migration, environmental disasters with a global impact, a violent conflict that could even have a nuclear dimension, seems to me the risks are vastly greater than they would be with a successful transition. I simply cannot understand those who, I refer now to Americans who one hears from time to time, like Pat Buchanan, I suppose, who claim that some collectivist abstraction called the national interest of the United States is not at stake in what happens in the transition. Now, there's also been a fair amount of discussion about what is at stake for the developing countries. One encounters, or in the case of Latin America, one used to encounter, because Latin self-confidence has flooded back recently, widespread concern that trade, aid, investment, and technical expertise will be diverted from them to the economies in transition. I would actually quite like to believe that the diversion of economic expertise away from the developing countries is going to be an enormous blow to them, but I must confess that I've still not quite convinced myself that they're going to miss us that much. But obviously no one can guarantee that there will be no such diversion, and indeed the most serious study that I know of that tried to look at the diversion of trade and investment, the Collins and Roderick study published by our institute last year, concluded that this could be significant, especially through the higher interest rates that are likely to result from increased investment demand as recovery gathers force. So there will be some cost there, but it's not clear that it will be enormous. In terms of aid going to the East, that seems to be largely additional, so far at least. Perhaps the Central Asian countries will be much more competitive. The little Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan and those ones will be much more competitive because they are going to need long-term concessional aid for a long time rather than the sort of emergency relief that one can truly hope will be additional. I think it's quite exaggerated to see a danger of foreign direct investment being diverted away from existing recipients. Direct investment expands to fill the investment opportunities available, and new investment opportunities in the East will mean primarily more direct investment worldwide rather than diversion of a fixed fund from one area to another. And I'd even argue that the same may happen with trade. More production of clothing in Eastern Europe may encourage Western Europe to import more clothing and divert the resources into producing goods that can be sold to the East rather than cutting imports from the Third World. I'm not saying that's inevitable, but I do think that those of us who worry about those things should focus on the need to try and make it happen rather than bellyache about a threat from the East. Then there are the questions about the relations between East and West. If things go right, the East is going to be absorbed in the West. That's their desire, and I can't see any legitimate Western interest in preventing it happening. The process has indeed already started, and it will continue this year with the entry of most or all of the 15 former Soviet republics into the IMF and the World Bank. If the transition makes good progress, it will continue with the entry of the Central European countries into the OECD and subsequently into the European Community, and then one day Russia will make the G7 into the G8. But perhaps the big issue that we're going to have to think about concerns the European community, because enlargement is not necessarily going to stop with just absorbing the three countries of Central Europe. I think the real long-run question is whether Europe is interpreted to include or exclude the two countries that straddle both Europe and Asia, namely Russia and Turkey. Let me conclude by saying that I've now identified above several respects in which, with the benefit of hindsight, we can see that the transition could have been handled better. I think we could have benefited from more transitional protection and early small privatization, Czechoslovakia adopting an unnecessarily tough macro stance, and above all, I think it was a mistake not to follow the path of monetary reform and sanitization of the balance sheets of enterprises and banks to let them start off with a clean sheet. Perhaps some of those things could still be done, though I must say the natural time to do them was when the bangs occurred, and I think the opportunity may have been lost by now. Nevertheless, I think the primary advice that we should address to Eastern Europe at the present stage must be to hang tough where a bang has already happened, and to grit their teeth and take the plunge in those places where it has still not occurred. There are no demons whose ouster will take the pain out of the transition, and no panaceas whose implementation will guarantee a rapid turnaround. There is a far greater danger of the transition being aborted because of a surrender to populist pressures than because some desirable policy modifications remain unmade. Now, such advice would, in my view, be hypocritical without a willingness to help. But once again, one encounters here one of the profound changes in policy attitudes that has crystallized during the past decade. We no longer take it as axiomatic that more aid is going to help the recipient. Aid has sometimes been used to perpetuate that which had to be eliminated if recovery was to have any chance. To avoid that danger, aid has to be geared to supporting programs of real reform. Where such reform programs are in place, then I think we should be prepared to spend real money. And to me, that criterion suggests that we've been spending too little in the Balkans, and that we've been much too hesitant in offering serious aid, a stabilization fund and balance of payments support, to Russia, once they get to the next step. I think one's still right to stand back and say they have to demonstrate that the budget is indeed under control and that the central bank will enforce a stringent monetary policy. But they really ought to be getting at this stage a signal from the West that once those things... after, then the West will be willing to put in substantial support. The present economic team needs some Western endorsement in a form that the Russian people can understand will be of benefit to them, and which they can see they would suffer if it was withdrawn, in order to strengthen the political hand of that economic team in the infighting that is likely to continue in Moscow for a long time yet. Most unlikely that any subsequent economic team would match up to the present team. Well, I think it's a pity to have to end a discussion of such great issues by policy advice almost as boring as that which one dispenses when one testifies to the US Congress, which one always ends up saying, fix the budget deficit. But since the duty of economists is to give good advice rather than entertaining people, I will end at this point.
Thank you very much. There is time for questions and discussion. I'll take questions and Professor Williamson will answer them. Professor Goodhart?
I was unclear how you thought credit expansion could have been better organized in a system where most enterprises continue to have soft budgets. And I
No, I don't think that one can avoid it without some degree of credit rationing. I think it's a case of the degree of credit stringency that came about as a result of the large increases in import prices at the same time as the attempt to control the nominal value of credit outstanding to avoid additional credit expansion. And it was that combination which then produced a very sharp credit contraction. Now, is that...
How do you measure the extent of that credit contraction? And in particular, how do you measure the extent of the excessive credit contraction?
Measure the extent of it is simple enough. You take the nominal value of credit and you divide it by the index of input prices, presumably. How much you say is excessive, I'm not sure that I would be able to answer that question. That's a much tougher question. There one needs some norm as to what is necessary, and it was desirable to have some additional pressure on credit. I wouldn't deny that. In many of these countries, inventories were excessive, and one wanted pressure to draw on those inventories. But in fact, that might even be an additional demand-side factor in explaining the fall in output, is the rundown of inventories. But nevertheless, the sort of paradoxes that Calvo and Coricelli point to of enterprises which were not paying the maximum wages they were allowed to, even though they were highly profitable in flow terms, suggests that they were trying desperately to improve their liquidity situation, and therefore that there was at least very great credit stringency. If one then, how one judges exactly when it's overshooting, well, that's a judgmental thing always, I guess. I mean, you could say the same thing with all of these. How do I judge that there was too much demand deflation in Czechoslovakia and that it wasn't just right in order to get prices to stabilize again after the one-off shock? You have to say, well, can you really see that it was necessary to have that combination of such severe deflationary policies? And I don't think I'm claiming any very sophisticated method is available for making those judgments.
Yes, I have two questions. Firstly, Professor Williamson, first of all, you may think two EP lectures will be printed.
Yes, I believe at the very least it will be printed in a working paper of the Center for Economic Performance, do you say?
Or
the Financial Markets Group, yes. So there will be a version of it.
Now the second question is, evidently food is rather essential for the main, for the great citizens of the Soviet Union. Now considering, say, Mujik profit maximizes by more or less making sure there would be not too much produced, otherwise shortage is the main profit maximizer as far as the state is concerned in the Soviet, in the former Soviet Union. How do you see to get a highly productive agriculture rather than an agriculture which benefits from the shortages?
Well, I'm sure it's going to be, privatization is again going to be the key, but it's going to be a long and difficult process in the Soviet Union. Collective agriculture is very heavily built in to the system, and there is now already a legal right to ask for land from the collective farm, but in many cases the collective farm manager also controls the local store, and if you are so impudent as to ask for your own land, you may have to go 50 miles to buy any inputs, and since you don't have any motor transport and you can't get any credit to buy any, that may be an obstacle. And so it's going to be a very difficult process, privatization of land. You don't have a peasantry that is itching to get back like you did in China. It's an enormously different situation. But There is a story in one of the papers today about one of the exceptions, a Ukrainian collective farm manager who is going private. You know, he's taken his bit of the collective farm and is going private. He didn't tell anybody he was planning it until he'd got far enough down the road to be able to overcome the obstacles, but not everybody has his advantages.
How would you regard the man here as a set of useful entrepreneurial types facing inappropriate legislation?
A lot of them, I think one should regard that way, yes, yes. But I think that's dead right. And also, of course, it means that the argument that one shouldn't worry about the inflationary, the monetary overhang being inflated away because one didn't want the people who built up money holdings to get their hands on the assets looks a lot less convincing once one recognizes that at least in many cases the mafia, as you put it, were exactly budding potential entrepreneurs facing inappropriate prices and regulations.
Yeah. What sort of balance of payments support should Russia be provided with, and what billions are we talking about, and who should provide it?
Well, the usual sort of figures are something like 15 to 20 billion a year for Russia and another 10 or 15 billions for the rest of the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. Not sure that these figures have any very adequate base except to say that's about the same proportion of Russian GDP that Western Europe got during the years of the Marshall Plan, and that was mighty useful to us, so maybe they could make use of something similar. These calculations are not done on a very satisfactory basis, but those are the sorts of numbers. Now, in the form in which it goes, I must say that I think a high priority should be given to a stabilization fund once there is a serious stabilization program there to support. I do not see that Russia can be expected to stabilize successfully on the basis of an exchange rate such as it has mostly been recently. Though my latest facts from Moscow tells me the market rate is now down to 70 rubles to the dollar. It was up to 100 to 150. Of course, its purchasing power parity would be something like 5. That's a terrible criterion. Never look at purchasing power parities, but if you look at fundamental equilibrium exchange rates and you sort of do a calculation which says what would be a sensible wage level for Russia at the moment, well, surely not less than $100 a month, and you still come out at something like 20 or 25 as a or at most as a plausible exchange rate. So it really is important to try and get the exchange rate to come to a level which bears some relationship to the fundamentals, because even though Russia is a very closed economy, nevertheless, an exchange rate as over-devalued as the ruble has been has to have a big inflationary impact. Make stabilization that much more difficult. So I would certainly give priority to that, and 7 billion, the normal rules of thumb say 7 billion is the right size for a Russian stabilization loan. That's 4 months' imports at the rate that Russia was importing from the rest of the world, not the rest of the Soviet Union, in 1990, I guess, before the collapse occurred. Maybe it was 89. beyond that, yes, balance of payments support. One may want to dress it up as loans for particular infrastructure investment or food aid or whatever. All those things can be useful and have a legitimate place, but fundamentally, I think one wants to make sure that enough aid is moving rapidly to give a stabilization program a chance. The Who should give it? It's going to be a mixture. Clearly, the international institutions are going to have a major role, but they don't command the resources necessary to cover all of a programme of that size, and so there's going to be a need for substantial bilateral assistance or assistance coordinated through the international organisations in the way that has already been done for many of the East European countries. And since the Washington conference last month on aid, it looks as though a mechanism will be put in place.
Yes, sorry, another one of the questions from the professor seems to be arguing for a big time restriction, and yet the information gave us the information by the countries that wanted to transition seems to be controlled much better. And what I found out
yeah, I think, well, the argument which I ended up presenting was that in the case of many countries, there simply was no way of doing a gradualist program. Things had, by the time the reformers came to power, they simply were not in a position to make that choice. Eastern Germany didn't have to do it in a big bang. Eastern Germany was actually the biggest bang of all. They didn't have to. They could have. They had a real choice. So did Czechoslovakia, and so did Hungary. But the others, I don't think that there was a real choice. And so even though the economies which did a gradual program showed better performance, that possibility didn't exist. Okay, well then one looks at Czechoslovakia, which is the one, which is a case that had a bang and didn't need to. Would that have been better? Would it have been better to have done a gradual program? And it still seems to me that the logic that I outlined yesterday was applicable in that case, that it did make good sense to do the big bang. The bits that I regret their having done was the excessive deflation on the demand side. And that was a mistake which then prevents us turning around and saying, look how nicely the Big Bang has worked. I think that's terribly unfortunate that we don't have a case study that we can hold up. Even, incidentally, even after the Big Bang in Czechoslovakia and the excessive demand deflation there, the output figures are not that much worse than Hungary. I mean, it's about 5% bigger deflation, according to these Morgan Stanley figures. So it's not that much extra. Had one not had the mistake on the demand side, then I think we might well be able to point to superior performance, and that indeed would have made my task this evening much easier. You're quite right.
Well, we've kept Professor Williamson for an hour and 20 minutes, and I think that that's a bit above and beyond the call of duty. Can I thank you, Professor Williamson, on all our behalves for what's been a very lucid and informative set of lectures. Thank you for sharing with us the problems of transition. They're not just one set of problems for one country, but many problems for many countries, and thank you for exposing the diversity which still has to be addressed. Thank you very much indeed.